Hello and welcome to the Litigation Podcast presented by Blackstone Chambers. Join our barristers as they discuss their expertise on trending topics and debates in the legal sector. If you want to be part of the discussion, subscribe below to receive our latest episodes.
Welcome to part two of Blackstone Chambers Retained EU Law Conference Series. I'm Kieran Beale KC, and in this episode, our panel will explore the potential impacts in key affected sectors such as employment, environmental law, tax, financial services, telecommunications, and energy. Our panel consists of Naina Patel, Holly Higgins, Ravi Mehta, Emily Neal, Harry Adamson, James Segan KC, Gayatri Sarathy, and Tom de la Mer KC.
Without further ado, I am going to introduce Naina Patel. Naina has significant experience in competition law. Following a secondment at the Office of Fair Trading, she's been advising on a variety of competition litigation ever since, including the now famous Volvo decision that you're all waiting to hear about. Naina will put us out of our misery very shortly. Her fun fact is that she nearly delivered a baby in court. So this is a theme. This is a Blackstone Chambers theme that is developing. Naina, over to you.
And that was my own, I hasten to add. So I've got 8 minutes to talk about this decision of mind-bending complexity. Declaration at the outset, I appeared in the CAT for MasterCard. It's unclear at the moment if the case is going further, so I will be slightly limited in what I can say. But the reason for talking about it, you've had some allusions to its significance. Perhaps the biggest decision in the competition sector concerning retained EU law, and the sector I'm giving you an overview about is competition. It's a striking example of the potential impact of a post-IP completion decision on national law. But most importantly for this morning, it's important for its implications for what falls within Section 4 of EWA, so as to be affected by RULA and its sunsetting provisions. In particular, the question of whether RULA will involve sunsetting accrued rights under provisions that fall into Section 4 of EWA. So it's all about what is an accrued right and is an accrued right part of retained EU law, such that it would be caught by the provisions on RULA that involve sunsetting parts of retained EU law. What is the decision? There's a summary on the slide, which I won't go through in detail, but in essence, it concerned the meaning and effect of a post-IP decision of the ECJ called Volvo. And the claimants argued that this Volvo decision meant no part of their claim was time-barred, even when the relevant competition infringements that were alleged had occurred more than 6 years before the issue of proceedings. So even when they had occurred before the time period that national law set for limitation purposes. They said that Volvo, this post-IP completion decision, meant that limitation periods applicable to actions for damages for infringements of competition law could not begin to run before the infringement had ceased, which is a pretty radical statement. And the infringements in these cases were said to be ongoing. So to the extent that national limitation laws were inconsistent with Volvo, they had to give way to it, and they had to give way to it because it was binding, even though it was a post-IP completion day decision. Now, the decision itself, the CAT actually disagreed with the claimants as to what the meaning of Volvo was. So the 70-odd pages that you have talking about retained EU law and accrued EU law rights, you might say is strictly obiter. But that is where I'm going to focus for the purposes of this morning. So the relevance of this, I mean, the case all turned about on what does Section 6.1a of EWA apply to? Does it apply only to retained EU law, or does it apply also to accrued EU law claims, meaning claims which have arisen prior to IP completion under a substantive provision of EU law, but have not been issued or determined before that date? Section 6 is obviously headed to the interpretation of retained EU law. So the question then arises, what is retained EU law? Section 6.1a, as we know, says a court or tribunal is not bound by the principles laid down or any decisions made on or after exit day by the European Court. And 1B, as we know, says that you can't make a reference. The defendants said that these claims, which were claims under Article 101 of the treaty, concerned retained EU law. So Section 6.1a applied, and this Volvo decision did not bind and should not be followed. The claimants said that these claims concerned accrued EU law rights by reason of Section 16 of the Interpretation Act, such that they were unaffected by EUA, which was only prospective in effect, with the effect that Volvo was in fact binding on the domestic courts in relation to such claims, accrued EU law right claims, just as it would have been pre-IP completion day. So the case is important for its discussion of retained versus accrued EU law rights and the consequent impact of RULA, as I've indicated. A recap on retained EU law so that we can understand the decision. The definition there in 6.7 of EUA defines retained EU law as anything which on or after IP completion day continues to be or forms part of domestic law by virtue of Section 2, 3, or 4, which is the one we're focusing on here, and then the provisions about as that body is added to or otherwise modified. Within retained EU law, there are three subcategories. Retained general principles of EU law, retained EU case law, and retained domestic case law. And a recap on the Interpretation Act, which is the other set of provisions we need to look at to understand the decision. Section 15, where an act repeals a repealing enactment, the repeal does not revive any enactment previously repealed unless words are added reviving it. And then 16.1, without prejudice to Section 15, where an act repeals an enactment, the repeal does not, unless the contrary intention appears, affect any right, privilege, obligation, or liability acquired, accrued, or incurred under that enactment, and E, a provision in relation to investigations and legal proceedings and remedies. And any such investigation, legal proceeding, or remedy may be instituted, continued, or enforced as if the repealing act had not been passed. So what is the relevance of the Interpretation Act here? The context is EUA, which repeals the 1972 Act. So the question is, what is the impact of EUA if it's an act which repeals an enactment, here the 1972 Act, on accrued rights such as those under Article 101 of the treaty? What happens to proceedings begun in respect of such claims pre-IP completion day? The claimants, as you'll see, argued that the effect of the Interpretation Act is effectively that those accrued rights are treated as unaffected by the repeal in the absence of any contrary intention, and they say there was no contrary intention in EUA. What did the CAT decide? So there are two judgments. There's a majority judgment from Sir Marcus Smith and Ben Tinswell, and there is a concurring judgment from Mr. Justice Roth. They're quite hard going, so bear with me. Firstly, is there a repeal? So their analysis of whether there is a repeal on which the Interpretation Act can bite is that the law giving rise to enforceable EU law rights flowing into domestic law via Section 2.1 of the 1972 Act cannot actually be repealed by Section 1 of EUA. And that's because these rights are a creature of the EU, not a creature of Parliament. So although Section 1 of EUA in one sense repeals the 1972 Act, all it's doing is affecting the gateway through which rights, EU law rights, flowed into our legal system. It does not abrogate the rights themselves, because those rights are creatures of EU law, but that our Parliament is unable to technically abrogate. All that happens is they cease to be relevant domestically as EU law rights, and they are translated into domestic law. And the majority decide that this process of translation into domestic law isn't a repeal. And then two examples of this they give. Section 3 of EWA, which we know relates to direct EU legislation. What it does is effectively turn EU legislation into domestic law. Things which were directly effective are translated and implemented into domestic law. So there's no repeal of the relevant rights. And then Section 4, where our focus is for this case, any rights, powers, liabilities, obligations, restrictions, remedies, and procedures which immediately before IPCD are recognised and available in domestic law by virtue of Section 2.1 are enforced, allowed, and followed accordingly. Majority finds that this is where treaty rights, that Article 101 of the treaty sit, but not just the substantive law provisions, also causes of action arising out of them. And that means that not just the substantive right, but the accrued right that might rely on that substantive right continues on to be recognised and available in domestic law. So I'm going to canter through the rest of this in 2 minutes. So what this means is that all these rights are caught by Section 4, both the substantive right and the accrued right. However, there is special provision for competition rules. Regulation 62 of the regulations set out on the slide effectively turns off, takes out these Article 101 treaty rights from Section 4. And why does it do that? It does that because we have Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 in domestic law. But then we have a saving in paragraph 14.2 of Schedule 4 to these regulations for making or continuing claims in UK courts relating to pre-IPCD infringements. So accrued rights are the subject of an express saving, and the majority effectively treat this as an indication that their analysis is correct. This provision takes accrued rights, which sit in Section 4, effectively out of Section 4, and then makes an express saving for them. I'm not going to go through this slide, but this gives you an analysis of some of the features that they rely on in support of their analysis being right. I'm going to focus on the sort of main point of distinction in the concurring judgment of Mr. Justice Roth. He basically disagrees that these accrued rights live in Section 4 of EWA. He says that can't be right because Section 4.1 says it doesn't apply to rights, powers, and liabilities that form part of domestic law by virtue of Section 3. And there's no equivalent language in Section 3. So it can't be right that all accrued rights of all kinds sit in Section 4 because it excludes Section 3 and there's no equivalent provision for accrued rights in Section 3. But he says that accrued rights are still retained EU law. And he reaches that analysis through a sort of holistic analysis of what EWA is doing. And so both judgments reach the conclusion that accrued rights are in fact retained EU law, but the route by which they get there is different. Why does this matter? On the majority thesis, the sunset of Section 4 of EWA by virtue of Section 2 of RULA impacts all retained EU law, including accrued rights based on Article 1 of the treaty and indeed all accrued rights. But on its own, that's pretty radical. But we then have to look at Section 22.5, which provides that Section 2 does not apply in relation to anything occurring before the end of 2023. So that appears then to be another carve-out. You might say that that carve-out reinforces the majority view that accrued rights are otherwise part of retained EU law, because the carve-out is there to sort of reflect that although they're being taken out of Section 4, they're now being put back in. But there is another view, and Tom de la Mer can perhaps come in on this in discussion later. If you follow through the analysis and you consider the interplay with other sections of RULA, like Section 11, if accrued rights are part of retained EU law, then does that mean they are subject to the ability to restate? And what does that mean in terms of implications for rights which you might say have crystallised at an earlier point in time, but now might be the subject of the executive perhaps changing the way in which they're given effect to? I'm afraid I've run out of time. There are some other provisions on the slides which sweep out changes that have been made by RULA in the competition area, but I think I'll leave you with this sentence, which is that I think competition law is not an area in which there's been huge change from RULA, because it does seem to be a sui generis regime. Things like the vertical block exemption have already been turned into domestic law. So at the moment, it's not an area where there's a lot of action in Section 1 of RULA, and it's probably other areas that are going to be more dynamic in the first instance. I'm sorry I've run over a little bit.
Thank you very much indeed. Now on to Holly. Holly Higgins is instructed regularly in employment disputes, including in mass equal pay claims brought against a number of retailers. She's acted for Apple in collective proceedings in the CAT, and she's appeared for the Welsh Government in two Supreme Court appeals. Fun fact, we're moving on from the act of birth to consequences. Four of Holly's stepsisters are quadruplets.
So I've been asked to talk to you about the impact of the RULE Act on employment law, and I decided to take how it's going to affect equal pay law as a case study in some of the practical implications of the idea that from 2024, all of these retained directly effective rights are gone. In order to understand where we're going, we need to understand where we've come from. If we wind the clock back, say, 5 years, we're in those heady days before the EUA 2018, a claimant kind of had to look at three different camps of law. The first thing you would look at is our homegrown Domestic Equality Act equal pay regime, and that's in Chapter 3 of Part 5. And that was our successor to what used to be the Equal Pay Act 1970. You don't tend to have to look at that act anymore just for limitation reasons. Sitting alongside that, you had directly effective EU law rights coming through from Article 157 of the treaty, and this is the one we all learned about at law school, Dufresne, and the air hostess case. And then anything that didn't fall within those regimes, and it's pretty rare, but you could have a case, for example, about access to discretionary training schemes, you'd end up just running that through your standard Section 13 direct discrimination or Section 19 case law, but that's sort of less claimant-friendly for various reasons. What happened under EUA? Come Brexit, the answer is not much, because all of those directly effective rights under 157 just become retained EU law under Section 4 of the Act, when we keep alongside that our Chapter 3 of the Act. What was going to happen under the RULE Act? Well, initially, alarm bells start ringing, because these are all directly effective rights that were retained, and under the Act, they will all be gone as from 1st of January. Alarm bells started ringing in a lot of employers' lawyers' mind because Article 157 is still pretty useful for claimants in two main ways. The first way it's useful is asking, well, who can my client compare themselves with? The short point is this. When a claimant wants to compare themselves with a colleague working in another establishment, so gone, you know, we're no longer in those days where often you want to compare yourself to someone in the same office. These days, where you've got Amazon, big supermarket retailers, you've got complicated corporate structures, tons of different workplaces, and you want to get into these cross-establishment comparisons. Under the domestic regime, you have to show, A, that they're employed by the same or an associated employer. Basically, that's defined to mean you're in a sort of parent company or holding company kind of corporate situation. And then you have to show that common terms apply as between the two establishments. Following a case that I did called Asda and Brearley, the headline is, common terms test pretty easy to satisfy, but you might fall foul of it where your employer can show that there are different regimes applying, wholly or mainly because of geographical differences. Your classic kind of House of Lords example is where you've got one workplace in London, one workplace in Nottingham, say, and the employer says, well, because cost of living is higher in London, everyone's pay is bumped up by 10 grand or something. Contrast EU law, where we have a much simpler comparability test. It's called the single source test. In essence, as long as you can show that the difference can be attributed to a single source so that there's something that can remedy the inequality, you can get home. And then there was a recent CJU case that went up on one of those very last-minute pre-Brexit references where they said, it doesn't matter if you're in different establishments, and all the, by the way, all of this applies when you're in an equal value case. The second way in which Article 157, even in its retained form, is helpful is what you can compare. Here the headline is, in broad terms, if you're within the Domestic Equality Act, you have to compare terms and conditions of your contract. So everything has to come down to the contract. Contrast EU law, where the only controlling concept was really the idea of pay, and the CJEU said you interpret that broadly and it can encompass discretionary elements of pay. So if you've got a case where you've got two discretionary bonus schemes, let's say one for your retail workers and one for your distribution workers, Article 157, you can bring that within the comparative regime. So Rule Act comes in, everyone starts freaking out because they think, God, we're going to lose all of these directly effective equal pay rights, and there are some cases where the EU law rights are really helpful. Cue a lengthy summer of objections, and the government realises, hang on, this isn't playing very well, so we get a nice little U-turn. At the end of August, the quote was, there will be absolutely no reduction in equal pay protections, the new secondary legislation will be laid before the end of the year. So on paper, we've got a commitment to effectively replicating these retained EU law rights in secondary legislation, presumably the intention being they're going to use the Section 11 restatement powers. But then that in itself raises a lot of interesting questions. The first question is a purely practical one. As I've explained, what we currently have are these two parallel equal pay regimes that partly overlap and partly don't overlap. One would think if you started from a blank slate, the ideal way of legislating is just to do a wholesale rewrite of Chapter 3 of Part 5 and just have a coherent equal pay regime that's broader in all the ways that EU law was broader. But I suspect the government is thinking, well, hang on, can we do that using the Section 11 power? Because albeit the Section 11 power in theory can be used to modify primary legislation, it's fundamentally a power to restate retained EU law. So on one view, this power could be used, for example, to insert new provisions into the Equality Act that say, well, yes, you can use that regime if you're over here, but if you know you don't fall within that regime, then you can come under here. And you're still left with two parallel regimes just housed within one piece of primary legislation. That potentially is the way this is going. So at the moment, all we've got are some draft statutory instruments dealing with equal pay law in the field of occupational pensions. And basically what the government has done is codify this case called Allenby, which said if you're in the pensions world, you can point to a hypothetical comparator, you don't have to have an actual one. And what this statutory instrument does is basically add new subsections to the relevant bits of the Equality Act and sort of say, you know, if within occupational pensions world, then can rely on a hypothetical comparator. So it looks like we might be headed, at least for this interregnum period, for a statute with two different jigsaw, partially overlapping, partially not regimes to deal with equal pay. And that led to my second question, which is, will domestic judges, faced with a bit of chaos, try to bring a bit of harmony just through judicial interpretation? And I'll give you one example that sprung to my mind. I've given you the received wisdom that under domestic law, you're looking at terms and conditions of your contract. But in Scotland, the Court of Session had a case to do with discretionary bonus schemes and said, oh, well, on the facts of this case, everyone who was employed got a bonus. So the contract of employment was a kind of condition precedent or a qualifying condition of the bonus scheme. And we think that's enough to basically say the bonus scheme is sort of regulated by contract. So bingo, you're into the Equality Act regime. Bit of a creative lawyering there, but you can see how judges might be a little bit more attracted to pulling stuff within the kind of normal Equality Act regime, if I can put it that way. Alternatively, what are judges going to do when they're faced either with some sort of freestanding equal pay regulations of 2024 or a set of regulations that insert new provisions into the Equality Act? Inevitably, EU law provides us with these broad textured rules and principles that are then worked out in case law. Now, you've heard from Tom that what I might call retained EU law is in fact nothing to do with retained EU law. The Act says, right, we're taking all of that stuff out of the old EU regime. So all of those provisions about relying on retained EU case law don't directly apply. But there is a provision under Section 11 where the government can basically port in all of that case law. So it could pass these regulations and say, and in construing this, look at everything the CJEU said before 2024. One might think that's potentially unlikely to happen, given that that's not very consonant with the idea of Brexit freedom and our judges doing whatever they want. So then we're in a world in which English judges are looking at this retained EU law and thinking, okay, well, can I interpret that by looking at EU law? To what extent is that binding? To what extent can the judges say, well, I know, we all know that this provision started life as EU law, and so it ought to be relevant what the CGEU thought that meant in particular factual scenarios. And I'm happy to say that this is an exam topic that I get to set without answering it, because my friend and colleague Emily is going to answer it in more detail. So I leave you with the thought that at least in employment law, we have a promise of no change that's probably concealing a great deal of thorny issues and potentially change going forward.
Thank you very much indeed. We're going to move on to Ravi Mehta, who sits on my left. He's appeared in a number of cases before the Grand Chamber of the CJEU. He appeared in the Client Earth proceedings, which is some of the highest profile litigation concerning environmental EU law before the UK courts. And he also appeared in the case involving the family of Ella Adu Kissi Deborah in the second inquest into her death, which concluded for the first time that air pollution exposure was a medical cause of death. Ravi's fun fact, we're moving on from quantity of siblings to the fact that his first few years were spent in an EU commission creche. So he is the real deal.
Thank you, Kieran, for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be here and to speak to you about environmental issues at what's an interesting time. Environmental metaphors are quite often rolled out when one talks about the impact of EU law. Most famously, for those of you in the room, there's the often cited view of Lord Denning that EU law in Bulmer and Bollinger was an incoming tide flowing into the estuaries and up the rivers of English law, which seems to have remained with generations of English as well as EU lawyers. And it's perhaps not surprising then that one of the principal asserted benefits of Brexit by the government in its 2022 paper was that we could take back control of our democracy, our borders, and of our waters. In short, the environment has always been a key topic of life after Brexit for the United Kingdom. Prior to the UK joining the European communities, as it then was, the UK was often described as the sick man of Europe due to the issues that we'd had with air pollution, water quality, waste across the coastline. And in its 2016 report, Parliament's Environmental Audit Committee stressed that EU environmental legislation had made the UK into a leader in environmental policy and had improved bathing water, air quality, and waste disposal. So what was the stated objective for the UK's environmental policy post-Brexit? I've excerpted some key bits there from the 2022 paper, and the government stressed that there was an opportunity for us to go further and faster than the EU in tackling climate change, in protecting our natural environment, and in implementing what it called a world-leading framework for the environment. Despite those lofty ambitions, controversies continue to brew to this day. Many of you will be aware of the coverage over the past year of issues such as sewage discharge and the potential consequences which arise when things go wrong, or air pollution continues to be a very topical issue, particularly following the controversial extension of the ULEZ by the Mayor of London recently. Now, turning to the law of the UK's withdrawal from the EU, since Brexit and before the Rule Act, environmental cases have not been unusual or changed the analysis that you've heard this morning. I've identified some recent examples which applied the orthodox approach that was summarized by others. The first two involved the habitats regulations, and the third involved two acts of directly applicable retained EU legislation. In summary, before the Rule Act, EU retained law remained highly relevant, especially for historic cases. What I want to explore briefly today is two themes following the Rule Act: substantive law and enforcement post-Brexit. Starting with the substance, as you can see, a huge part of the EU retained law, which we've retained under the Withdrawal Act, relates to environmental issues. The updated UK government dashboard puts this at fully one-third of all EU retained law. So adjusting, assimilating, and restating this is going to be no simple task and is one of great significance. Technically, the new Act could do away with vast swathes of legislation in this field. And in the 2022 paper, the government estimated that 80% of our environmental regulation came from the EU. I've set out an overview of the existing UK framework and legislation. You can see on the left that there are key domestic acts, including at the bottom devolved legislation. But on the right, you can also see the range of very important EU-derived legislation. And this second category is part of that blue bubble we just looked at, which could be lost if not restated and replaced before 2026. The Rule Act, I think, in its final form, there are 6 points really to think about. The first, as others have stressed, is that the government pulled back from the cliff edge of full sunsetting of EU law by the end of this year. There is still the 3-year deadline before any legislation not restated will be removed. Interestingly, the Act, secondly, did not include a non-regression clause in relation to environmental matters, and that's despite specific parliamentary debates to that effect, and particularly House of Lords amendments that tried to enshrine non-regression, but was eventually overruled by the House of Commons. And despite the fact that non-regression for environmental matters is enshrined expressly in the TCA, and I'll come back to that a bit later. The third point is that, as others have mentioned, there are a range of sunsets and repeals in the final act, and that does extend to environmental matters. I've given some examples, but really that doesn't concern the principal retained EU law that I summarized in the earlier slide. The fourth point is that DEFRA has informally stated in a number of conferences and elsewhere that it intends to restate and reincorporate retained EU law in this field as much as possible. But as I noted earlier, without a major exercise in assimilation, the 2026 deadline, particularly for environmental legislation, is going to approach fast. And for the Trekkies in the audience, anyone who knows the Borg knows that assimilation is going to be a painful process. The government's initial position has always been that there is no backsliding, no dilution of EU environmental standards. But the sands may be shifting, and as you may have seen from the discussions about encouraging fracking or removing nutrient neutrality rules at local and national level in order to make planning permission easier, this is definitely a space to watch. My fifth point was about the removal of directly effective EU law rights, which is relevant in the environmental context, particularly because there are a number of these. They have often been process rights, whether under the Habitats Directive or the Air Quality Directive, but some of these process rights have a more substantive flavor to them. And I should note there that the removal of the principle of supremacy might very well influence the approach that English judges take in cases. I mentioned the Harris case on one of my earlier slides, and may eventually lead to a divergence between the approach of UK courts and EU courts, national or EU-specific courts. I should note that the Environment Act that the UK unveiled in 2021 is also more caveated than substantive EU law when it comes to, for example, the balancing of financial priorities and considerations versus environmental goals. The sixth point, actually, is also the abolition of general principles, and I've highlighted there the precautionary principle, which is critical in this field, which arguably is done away with by the Rule Act, although it may reappear in other guises. It's expressly enshrined in Article 356 of the TCA, and it's referred to in many domestic cases, such that English judges may seek to reinvigorate it through domestic law. Turning then to enforcement, sadly, this is an area where very impressive legal texts are often observed in their breach and are toothless. And so post-Rule Act, what will remain are two categories of enforcement: domestic, and I've identified the key public bodies there, and international, where international institutions in other places may still have a role to play. Domestically, one of the principal innovations of the 2021 Act was the creation of the Office for Environmental Protection. And it's the first time that the United Kingdom has had a bespoke regulator whose role is to supervise and to advance environmental protection. However, as I've stressed on my slide, the statutory test for its intervention is a high one, and so it's yet to be seen how regularly and how aggressively it will exercise its powers. It hasn't been tested in practice, but I should note that recent reports have identified an ongoing investigation by the OEP into alleged failures by DEFRA, by Ofwat and water companies in their failure to oversee and take action in relation to sewage discharges. As to international enforcement, well, starting with the TCA, it has four interesting features in the environmental context. The first is that a number of the articles emphasize what's called the freedom of each party to regulate matters and environmental issues. And in other words, the UK's stated intention to go further and faster than the EU should be compatible with the TCA. The flip side is the second point, that there is an explicit article requiring non-regression by both parties in relation to environmental matters, and a failure to respect that could lead to what so-called rebalancing measures by the other party. The third and fourth points are that under the TCRA, there has to be an impact assessment process and public consultation in relation to decisions that have at least major, but arguably even lesser, environmental consequences. All of these are untested, and I query whether the political will be there on either side to litigate this, particularly because the dispute resolution mechanism is still the CJEU. But at least politically, this may be relevant and may mean that the UK, at least in the environmental field, feels some pressure to actively use its powers to restate and assimilate retained EU law. There are other international institutions that remain relevant. Under the Aarhus Convention, for example, the Compliance Committee, which relates to public participation, though its powers of remedial powers are arguably limited. And also, interestingly, the Strasbourg Court and the European Convention, which has taken a greater interest in environmental cases, particularly in the area of climate change, but it's still early days. So in conclusion, I think we live in interesting times where opportunity and risk are colliding, and accordingly where vigilance as to the UK's environmental challenges is key. Thank you.
Thank you, Ravi. The only Borg I recall is Bjorn Borg, but that's showing my age. So I'm going to deal quickly with some tax issues. We were promised the sunlit uplands, and this is what we've ended up with. It's a bit of a minefield out there. Timing here is important. Let me give you a classic example in VAT, for example. When you go to a hotel, stay in a hotel room, you pay VAT on it. When you get a six-month short-hold tenancy for residential accommodation, you don't pay any VAT to your landlord unless, exceptionally, he or she's opted into the tax regime. What about if you are seconded from a Japanese bank to live in London for 3 months and you go into serviced accommodation, say in the heart of Chelsea, for the sake of argument, hypothetically speaking, not at all related to a case I've just argued. You're halfway between the two. So you might be on a lease for 3 months, but it is accommodation that, according to the UK domestic test, could conceivably be used by visitors, of which somebody relocating from a Japanese bank for 3 months might be a visitor. So you'd be within the scope of the test. EU test, however, is that the accommodation has to be in competition with the hotel sector, which arguably this isn't. So that's a classic example where the taxpayer would wish to rely on a directly effective right to invoke the exemption from VAT under the principal VAT directive and would want to argue about general principles of EU law, which ones, non-discrimination, proportionality, in the specific context of VAT, something called fiscal neutrality, which means that you should be taxed compatibly with your competition. Now, what that means is that for a given period, say a dispute arises in 2018 and continues until this year, you're going to have effectively four different regimes where your ability to rely on those general principles may or may not be affected. We know that Section 6.3 of EWA permits you to continue to rely on general principles after the IP completion day ended. And we now know that the ruler will give the quietest two general principles of law. So we've got a summary there of sunset clause, section 2, section 3, section 4, section 5, which James has been through. We've got the table that James stole from me. And then we've got now what section 5 of EWA actually looks like. First one is the principle of supremacy of EU law is not part of domestic law. And CA4, no general principle of EU law is part of domestic law after the end of 2023. So if this tax dispute were happening from January 2024, you can't rely on the direct effect of the directive, and you can't rely on the general principle of fiscal neutrality, subject to some saving provisions in Section 22 that have already been advanced. The issue, therefore, is to what extent can you rely on the historic position to justify a different tax treatment? Well, Section 1, in terms of the sunset clause in the tax sphere, hasn't had a huge impact. There's some information gathering powers that have been abrogated. Section 42 of the Taxation Cross-Border Tax Act 2018 had already dispensed with most direct EU law in this field, in the VAT field, save for a particular aspect of a particular VAT regulation that dealt with place of supply. Similar treatment for excise. Two to four, however, have a much bigger impact, and they have a much bigger impact for a number of reasons. Firstly, and this is where I'm afraid my varifocals don't allow me to follow it on that screen over there, which is too far away. So the revocation, for example, of the ability to rely on direct effect would have a tangible effect in the hypothetical example I've given you earlier. If I can't rely on the terms of the principal VAT directive to give me a broader exemption from VAT than the UK has chosen to implement, then my taxpayer will suffer. Secondly, the abolition of the supremacy of EU law means I can't trump the note in the VAT Act that says it has to be accommodation that is holding itself out as suitable for use by visitors. I can't overturn that particular legislative guidance and rely directly on the principal VAT Act. Fourthly, the abolition of general principles. I can't rely on fiscal neutrality going forward from 1st of January 2024 to say I should be treated in the same way as somebody who is in the private sector allowing residential accommodation on short-term leases. Is this a one-way street? Answer, yes. Section 42, 3 and 4 of the TCTA 2018 decided to continue to permit, as part of retained EU law, the use of two principles of EU law. Well, which are the ones that the legislature alighted upon? Firstly, the ability to control fraud and abuse through the cartel doctrine. Secondly, the ability to control abuse in a wider sense of tax avoidance, namely the Halifax doctrine. Now, these are tied in expressly in subsection 4 of the TCTA, section 42, to the concept of retaining EU law, and this being part of the retained EU law that the legislature has decided to keep, arguably because it's favourable to the revenue. Does that mean, post-ruler, that the revenue can no longer rely on Kittel and Halifax to deal with abuse and fraud? Well, the legislature may have thought it found a way around that with Section 98(1) of the Finance Act 2021 that inserted a new Section 4A in TCTA 2018, which says, intriguingly, accordingly, that principle may continue to be relied upon in determining any matter relating to value-added tax. But is that any matter precisely because it's retained EU law? And does the abolition of retained EU law mean that you have to construe subsection 4 and 4A together so that they no longer apply because general principles are out the window and the Cattell and Halifax were general principles of EU law, albeit ones that didn't redound to the benefit of a taxpayer? So that's an open issue to be discussed. Accrued rights in VAT law, we've had section 16. We then have the section 16(1) analysis. In essence, the argument runs as follows. Firstly, Section 2 of the ECA 1972 conferred rights on taxpayers until the end of IP completion day to pay tax in accordance with the law as it then stood. Nothing, it could be argued, in EWA has abolished that ability to rely upon accrued rights subject to the analysis of Mr. Justice Roth in Volvo or the majority in Volvo. What the court in Volvo did not at least appear to grapple with is the concept that the requirement under the Interpretation Act 1978 to show contrary intention has to be express, and Mr. Justice Roth's dissenting judgment on that point said there is no express provision. Secondly, it isn't simply rights that have accrued and asserted, as the majority might suggest. It's accrued rights even if they haven't been formally asserted. So there's quite a lot to play for. And Volvo may or may not be going on appeal, and Naina and I may or may not be involved in it. There is an orthodox position on accrued rights, which is the News Corp Times newspaper case, where the Supreme Court cut through the nonsense and just said, well, this case relates to historic entitlement to pay VAT in a certain way. We're simply going to treat it as being the application of EU law from those periods, end of. And then we have some slightly more interesting approaches from Lord Justice Green in the Jersey Choice case, who adopted more of the conduit style analysis and said that the reason why general principles of EU law could still be brought to bear in a Frankovich claim were precisely because Parliament had preserved them through a complicated system of transitional provisions. And then Gray and Farrer, where Lady Justice Simler adopted a similar approach and treated the relevant right to pay VAT in accordance with the principal VAT directive and general principles as being a feature of retained EU law rather than accrued EU law right. What does this mean generally going forward? Well, we're going to have to dig into some common law rights in a taxpayer's context in order to try and fill some of the gaps. You've got the FMX food case where dissenting decision of Lady Arden, recognised that there was probably a common law right to have your tax affairs dealt with within a reasonable period of time. And secondly, the DCM case, where the Supreme Court has strongly indicated that running forward with domestic construction of the VAT Act, concepts such as fiscal neutrality, which lie behind the entire regime for VAT, are simply going to be imported into the common law. Subsidy control, I don't have time for, but it still will feature, and there are provisions of the TCA that apply to tax. So just keep an eye out on that. That's me. And now we're on to Emily Neal. Emily Neal has a broad range of practice in public, commercial, competition and regulatory law. She regularly appears for government departments, regulators, and big names such as the BBC, Royal Mail, Times Newspapers, Vodafone, et al. There's considerable crossover between her practice in this jurisdiction and her practice in both Northern Ireland and Ireland, so she is triple qualified, like a good chip. Two fun facts, one of which I dispute is fun. Firstly, she sits on the Bar Council's retained EU Law Committee. Not that much fun. Secondly, she also gave birth to somebody in the back of a cab.
Thank you, Kieran. We've got a real theme going here, birth stories or taxis or whatever way we're going to put it. So the 2023 Act does not involve the same levels of high drama for telecoms and energy regulation as it does for some of the other sectors that my colleagues have been talking about. And I emphasise that it's the Act which doesn't cause high drama, because, of course, the potential fallout from Brexit for these sectors was fundamental, because they are, by definition, sectors that involve interconnection between states. And it is for that reason, the importance of interconnection, that there was an early flurry of Brexit legislative activity. So at the end of, before the end of 2020, there was a raft of SIs in the energy context. So effectively, to excuse the energy pun, onshoring EU energy, gas and electricity regulation into domestic law. And in the telecoms context, then we have primary legislation, which has already transposed the current EU regulatory regime in the Electronic Communications Code. And that is all because of the importance, this early work was all because of the importance of interconnection with other countries. So Kieran did a case last year, this SSE case about electricity transmission charges. And in that case, we have Lord Justice Green putting the point very neatly. Look, in the energy context, it's no part of domestic policy to diverge, because we need to have common rules because of the connected markets. This early onshoring of EU law means that in 2023, the questions for us under the new Act are largely questions of interpretation. And for those of you who are not remotely interested in electricity or gas or telecoms, happily they are broader questions as well, so they might be of some use to you. The primary and first question of interpretation is, how do you go about interpreting these onshored provisions of EU law? So, for example, where you have what is now just a vanilla provision of the Communications Act, but the original reason for the existence of that provision in primary law was the implementation of a directive, can you look to the directive to implement the UK domestic law? We know that Marleasing has gone, so we no longer have indirect effect. But in two separate judgments from the High Court in the summer, which I'm very grateful to James Segan for drawing to my attention, because I did not spot them from my sun lounger, His Honour Judge Tyndall applied a case called Cammon's Ballroom, which is a pre-EU accession case, so very suitably non-European, nothing to do with the EU. And that case sets out the principle that regard must be had to the context in which legislation was made, to its subject matter and its purpose. And Judge Tyndall reasoned that where you have a domestic instrument,
which had as its origins the implementation of EU law, then that EU measure is the context which throws light on the domestic parliamentary intention. And he stressed very strongly that this was absolutely nothing to do with EU law, that indirect effect had gone. This was purely domestic interpretation, but it was still a technique which would permit one to look back at the directive and the correct meaning of the directive to interpret UK law. And that neat solution may be the answer and may be the new Marleasing in many cases. But I think telecoms regulation is interesting because it gives us what I think is a very good example of the difficulties which could lie ahead in applying this. So telecoms nerds will recall that there was a degree of eye-rolling back in 2017 when there was a legislative amendment in the Digital Economy Act to change what had been an on-the-merits appeal to become instead an appeal where the principles which would apply in a judicial review were applied. And this was seen as largely posturing in telecoms, sparked by a raft of challenges to Ofcom. And it was posturing because there was already case law in the T-Mobile case, which said that even were a challenge to be brought by way of judicial review, the appeal standard which applied was a more intrusive merits appeal because that was what was required by the EU regulatory regime. There's a directive which imposes that requirement. So now, post 2023 Act, the interpretative conundrum is this. That EU-imposed merits standard has now gone because it was a standard imposed by a directive, and we know, to use the language of Section 2.2 of the 23 Act, that directive is no longer recognised or available in UK law. But it's not obvious that we can bring the directive back in through Cammon's ballroom because we have this 2017 parliamentary intervention which got rid of the language of on the merits appeal and instead put in the reference to judicial review. But query what was Parliament really thinking in 2017, because it adopted that language of judicial review in the clear knowledge that what was actually required was a sort of souped up on the merits judicial review. So did Parliament intend to actually get rid of an on the merits appeal? And if it intended to keep the EU standard, which is what the context would have required, then why did it use the language of judicial review and oust that language? So this is a real conundrum and one which the courts have yet to grapple. So the Competition Appeal Tribunal ducked the question in the 2022 CityFibre case by saying, well, actually the grounds of appeal in this case are really just classic JR grounds, so we don't need to think about whether this is still an on-the-merits challenge. The second interpretation issue which arises in this interconnected sphere of energy and telecoms, and actually probably more broadly, is the difficulty that we already see the courts having now that they no longer have the preliminary reference procedure. And again, Lord Justice Green addressed this in the SSE case that Kieran did. Effectively saying, look, I need to interpret the regime for transmission charging consistently with other EU member states, because otherwise there's going to be distortion amongst the EU states and also within the UK because of Northern Ireland. But I can't ask the European Court anymore for the right answer to the interpretation. How about I ask the European Commission to come into this case and tell us what they think? Now, I can see real problems of principle with that. And ultimately, the judge didn't do it, the court didn't do it. But the reasons given were less reasons of principle and more reasons of practicality. So query whether this is actually something that we're going to start seeing, new novel techniques to achieve consistency where consistency is fundamentally important, or whether this was maybe just an expression of judicial frustration at the new position. I'm not going to make much of my final point because we're going to run out of time, but it's really just the anecdotal one that in this rush to create legislation prior to December 2020, there have been drafting errors. And one of those came up in the SSE case, where if you want to have a lovely example of how things can go terribly wrong in drafting. Have a look at that. There, the court couldn't fix that error using the Inco-Europe doctrine, but query whether in other cases, because there are bound to be other errors out there, whether the courts will use Inco-Europe or whether we'll start to see the government using some of those far-reaching powers that Tom talked about earlier.
Thank you very much indeed. Just as a footnote, we'd already tried to phone a friend in the form of the EU Commission in that case, and they refused to answer the phone. So it was Lord Justice Green's idea to then contact them formally. Anyway, moving on. We now have Harry Adamson, whose practice is predominantly in heavy commercial work and in financial services litigation in particular. He's a member of the Attorney General's B panel, and he's regularly involved in cases involving corruption, fraud, general misconduct in the city, and he frequently either fights for or against the FCA, London Stock Exchange, the CMA, and the Gambling Commission. Harry's fun fact is unrelated to children or birth. He used to be a background dancer for a boy band.
Thanks, Kieran. Yeah, last one. So there's been a lot of information thrown at you over the morning. I'm just going to try and hold your attention for 7 more minutes to tell you about the Financial Services and Markets Act 2023, which received royal assent on the same day as RULA. And I'm going to do that because it is the most significant piece of domestic financial services legislation passed, certainly in the last 20 years, and it heralds a fundamental change in the source and likely the content a bit uncertain, but likely the content of the laws which govern financial services in this country. And as we shall see, it also sets out a novel set of processes for bringing those changes about. It could be a conference in itself, this topic, but I'm going to race through it in the time that I have. A useful bit of background is understanding the political approach which underpins the entire act. And that stems from a government belief that, for the most part, issues covered by retained or now assimilated EU law would be best dealt with by UK regulators exercising their own rulemaking powers. And to bring that about, we are going to be treated to a smarter regulatory framework. You can see that here. Now, are we going to get the same regulatory framework, but maybe with a combed hair and a suit? No, we're not. Like your smart TV, your smart fridges, your smart phones, it means that our regulatory framework is going to be cleverer. So, the Financial Services and Markets Act 2023 repeals retained EU law relating to financial services in order to deliver a cleverer regulatory framework which is tailored to the UK. RULA will be replaced with rules set by our independent and expert regulators operating within a framework established by government and parliament. So the Act is intended to bring that about. It covers a lot of ground. I'm going to focus on part one, which has 3 chapters. And the way to remember how the structure of the Act operates is that each chapter sets out to try and solve a problem, a perceived problem, of having retained EU law. And by doing that, creates an even bigger problem, which the following chapter then attempts to solve. So it's basically the same structure as the little old lady who swallowed a fly in statutory form. And if you remember that, then you'll know your way through the Act, because it gets progressively worse. So if you think of retained EU law as the fly, what is the spider sent down in chapter one to go and get the fly? Well, the spider just revokes it all. That's the answer. And you can see that, revocation of retained EU law, section one, the legislation is revoked. That's all of it. Now, you can get a sense from subsection two of what that involves. It involves everything. And if you turn to schedule one, I contemplated putting it in a PowerPoint, but it's simply overwhelming. You'd spend the rest of this talk with it kind of looking up over my head trying to read it all. It's basically, if you're a financial services practitioner, you'd be forgiven for getting misty-eyed nostalgia going through the schedule, because it's all of financial services' greatest hits. You've got the prospectus regulation, the market abuse regulation, the capital requirements regulation, markets and financial instruments regulation. All of the EU law is in there. and under Section 1, it's revoked. Not immediately, you'll be pleased to hear, and we're going to come at the end to how this revocation is going to take place in practice. All right, so if the spider is us not having any law in financial services anymore, what's the bird, which we're going to send down Chapter 2 to try and get rid of that problem? So Chapter 2, that grants additional powers to ministers and regulators to fill the gaps in law left by the scorched earth policy of Chapter 1. So here we have new regulatory powers, including just the top subsection, the designated activities regime. Now, designated activities, they're going to be activities that don't require authorization. Those are covered by FSMA and the current FCA handbook. But they are subject to regulatory requirements. So it's things like offering securities to the public. Now, anyone who operates in financial services, you're going to get extremely used to this regime in the future. It's going to be a decent part of your practice. But the basic point is that under Chapter 2, the Treasury will now have powers to make new regulations to replace what we've lost, and the FCA, as our good patriotic domestic regulator, can make rules relating to those regulations. So it envisages this split of responsibility between ministers and the FCA to replace what we've lost. So that's the bird. It's the wholesale replacement of all of our EU financial services legislation by regulator and ministerial activity. We've heard a lot from Tom, in fact, as a recurrent theme about what issues this can create. So I won't go into that. But that's the problem posed by Chapter 2. And that's the bird. Right, so what does Chapter 3 do to try and ameliorate some of the problems you have with Henry VIII powers and anti-democratic ways of creating new laws? Well, I like to think of Chapter 3 as the cat of democracy. And that cat is sent down after the bird to create some kind of democratic accountability which you know, to solve the problem that arises when our key laws are created by regulators, at least. And we can see the cat of democracy here. And if you're worried that this metaphor was tenuous, I give you this slide. There's another one here. There he is, in cabinet, getting ready to hold people to account. So, the aims of this part of the bill, as described by the House of Commons Library, is to implement measures intended to ensure appropriate democratic accountability for regulators, considering the significant transfer of powers to them that the bill facilitates. That is the idea. And it's going to say, it says at the bottom of the description of the bill in the House of Commons Library, it would allow greater involvement, but the government argues not direction by the Treasury in the regulator's rulemaking process, as well as greater involvement by the Treasury Select Committee in FCA and PRA consultations. So that is the future. That's how these changes are going to be brought about. Where are we now? Well, the Treasury has put out a plan for delivery, which I referred to when talking about the smarter regulatory framework. This is also taken from the plan for delivery, and this is how the revocation is going to be brought about. Each piece of rule related to financial services is now within a transitional period, lasting until the repeal of each piece is individually commenced by Her Majesty's Treasury in a phased and sequenced manner. By the end of this transitional period, the UK will have created a new, smarter regulatory framework based on the FSMA model, but with enhancements to reflect the increased responsibilities of the regulators and to ensure appropriate scrutiny and accountability. So how is this going to be brought about? Well, the Treasury has published the beginning of a timetable for the creation of the necessary statutory instruments. It will largely then be the task of regulators to, in the word of the published timetable, make any rules to replace the repealed legislation as they consider appropriate in accordance with their remits and statutory objectives as set by Chapter 3, you've seen by the cat of democracy. So top of the list is the replacement of the prospectus regulation. That's going to come first. Second draft of that instrument has been published, and the intention is to lay it before Parliament before the end of the year, so watch this space. Now, I think all practitioners in this area will acknowledge that a consolidation of the sources of the rules in this area would make life easier. But the problem created is that we now will have rafts of secondary legislation and regulator rules which are of necessity rushed through at breakneck speed and potentially with minimal consultation, which makes them both uncertain, but also, given their status, by their nature, they are amenable to legal challenge. So what will be the dog sent in after the cat, or maybe, surprisingly, the goat that is sent in after the dog? The answer may well be litigation.
Great. I look forward to the horse being the Supreme Court. right. So that is as many dodgy puns based on rule and ruler as we can get into a two-hour session. I'm going to open up the floor generally for questions. I think we still have Tom de la Mer and James Segan at the end of the phone, so they're available to answer the particularly difficult ones. But over to you.
Just a quick question for Harry. On the last thing you told us about, surely the regulator could simply copy out, so we go from a period of start off with a period of certainty and then gradually amend over time to avoid the rushed nature and lack of consultation nature that you referred to.
Yes, thank you. That's a good question. So I think the rush doesn't come so much from the intrinsic timetable built into the Act. I think the revocation will only take effect when there's a statutory instrument bringing the revocation into effect. I think the rush is more political than that. And I think what the regulators might do to start off with is, if they do nothing, things will stay the same. But there's obviously a great deal of pressure on them to do something different. And it's, in theory, it's only if you want to do something different that you need to do this in the first place. But I think the most likely thing that will happen is there will be a pressure to do things slightly differently, not copy it out, and then we'll see where we get.
If I may, I was just going to add, I think that highlights two problems an earlier question also raised, which is with this whole regime across each of our topics. The first is legal certainty, where it's almost impossible to advise clients because everything is uncertain. And as we discussed with interpretation post-Mar leasing, different judges may go different ways, and the courts will have a big task, even if one doesn't get to litigation. And the second, really, I think, practical issue is resourcing, which I've been seeing across all these sectors, but is these regulators who now have much more expanded roles and the political pressure to which Harry alludes, are they being commensurately increased in terms of resourcing, personnel, and funding, CMA, all sorts of different bodies who now have new roles because their task is now much more involved? That's the question that will interest me.
Can I just add that BISMA in Chapter 1 contains in Sections 3 and 4 effectively sectoral equivalents of sections 11 and 12 of the REUL. It's basically a sectoral equivalent to the powers of delegated legislation in relation to, first of all, the transitional period, and secondly, thereafter. And the process of restatement and the boundaries of it might be quite similar. It's also the first place that there has been effectively any exercise of these powers. So there's been passed, and competition lawyers can prick up their ears at this point, something called the electronic money and payment card interchange fee regulations made at breakneck speed in July that effectively restates the interchange fee regulation powers and provides them on the payment services regulator. It's a very good illustration of what Harry pointed out, which is that by manipulation or control over the transitional period, effectively, there's a power to recast all of these foundational instruments, both in the transitional period and upon revocation. Massive power transfer.
This is following on from the point that Tom made and also Harry. There's obviously this sectoral specific revocation in financial services legislation, but to what extent does the Rule Act overlap with financial services, the new post-Brexit regime, specifically in terms of kind of these interpretive effects, so the general principles, supremacy, etc. Is it distinct completely, or is there a bit of overlap there?
It's completely distinct. There's none of the saving provisions, for instance, the ability to replicate the principle of supremacy or to replicate EU case law, etc. It's just a freestanding domestic power to make new domestic regulations, completely cut adrift of the EU regime.
So I think the regimes will have to run in parallel, but my understanding of FSMA 23 is it's trying to set a new slate, clean slate, of what will essentially be domestic regulation. And the interaction between that and RULA, to the extent that they would need it, would be redundant, in theory, if they've redone everything. But query whether there's any scope at all for anything to be left somewhere in the hinterland that hasn't been swept into Harry's spider.
Slightly trailed by Ravi, but if I were a client who has up till now been very happy with choosing English law to govern my transaction documents, given what we've heard this morning, what advice would you give to me as a client that I should, whether I should continue to have English law governing my contracts?
Well, speaking on behalf of lawyers across the UK, can I encourage you to continue to do so for two reasons. One, the common law happily and the commercial aspects of common law are largely unaffected by all of this. And secondly, the areas where it's coming in are bespoke, principally regulatory regimes or tax regimes, where in theory the choice of law for example, a commercial contract won't be changed substantially. That said, if, for example, it was a wind farm contract, then who knows? It becomes much harder to know where you cite, for example, your renewable contract for a renewable building, a renewable source, if, for example, the entire UK regime is no longer going to be predicated upon the environmental benefits that may come from the EU, for example. Just picking a topic off the top of my head. Anyone else with any thoughts on that? Do say, by the way, we need to retain EU law, UK law's preeminence in the commercial world. Otherwise, I'll be shot by the Bar Council.
The common laws works very well. And also, even in financial services, there are real dangers in this overall approach. But I think every practitioner would acknowledge there is scope for simplification and consolidation of the regime. It now just depends on, and the FCA is very good. So this is a new role that's been thrust upon it. And we'll just have to see.
Thank you. Earlier on, Gayatri said that Section 6 was sort of supposedly based on the principles of Lord Justice Arnold's just decision in Tunin. Be interested to know whether you think Tunin would be differently decided next year, or how we think the courts will actually go about the exercise in the task they've been set in Section 6.
Well, I mean, the explanatory notes to Section 6 say that it was based on the factors considered in Tunin, but really the overwhelming factor in both judgments in the Court of Appeal was legal certainty. And that's why, in that case, it was thought appropriate to follow the retained EU case law. Now, I think that there clearly is a sort of a drive towards probably departing from EU case law, or at least there's a signal in terms of the types of considerations that a court must now have regard to. But, I mean, it's not prescriptive. They're sort of considerations that they must have regard to, but they may have regard to others, and it's certainly not prescriptive in the approach. And so I think, you know, it's one of those, like many, many things we've spoken about today. We'll see how it goes. But I think for my part, I can certainly see the courts following the same direction that they have so far.
I mean, Martin Howe, I think, in that case, didn't leave any stone unturned in terms of trying to challenge the perceived wisdom. He cited international treaties. He cited, gave as full a reason as he could have given as to why the CJEU had gone down the wrong route. And Lord Justice Arnold simply disagreed and said none of the appeals to reason or logic make much sense. And by the way, this is the way the CJEU have been doing it for 20 years. So we're going to carry on following that. I don't, frankly, in VAT, I can't see, in many cases, any court departing substantially from fundamental tenets of VAT law, because it would cause chaos.
I think it's difficult to square the parliamentary indication that Gayatri looked at with the, in the public law context, the push towards purposive interpretation, which the Supreme Court has been very clear about. And so in that context, it's actually quite orthodox English law, and I think Emily's powerfully made the point about the pre-existing pre-EU case law. So it would actually, to my mind, be an arguable shift in the common law to suddenly say, notwithstanding the context of this legislation, the purposive interpretation, I am going to disregard it. They now have a statutory hook, I think, but it would seem to me, in traditional principles of precedent, you'd have to have pretty good reasons to depart.
Tom.
I was just going to say, I think the answer to that question depends upon what layer in the legislation you're dealing with. I think the further away you get from automatic retained EU law or Section 8 EUA retained EU law, then the more strong the presumption is that you're going to pull away from the legislation. And I think the powers to restate really confer a power to change the law in this way. You may restate some of the principles in the case law. Holly gave examples of, you know, restatement of the Allenby case. Those regulations in question very pointedly don't restate the Bauer case law. So in the process of restatement, you can flag what parts of the law you want and don't want, and thereby change the law.
James, this is like COVID all over again. I'm having to bring you in one by one.
Yes, sorry. but I want to make an observation about Emily's presentation, which occurred to me while he was speaking, which I think in a sense brings us full circle, because at the start I mentioned how it's critical to have regard to the whole of the sprinkler system of law that we're presently faced with. And as I was listening to Emily, I thought to myself, well, is there anything in the trade and cooperation agreement about telecoms appeals? Because there was an issue in IP about the enforcement directive. And you can go round the houses and end up at exactly the same position because there's part of the trade and cooperation agreement that says you have to do things in a particular way. In this case, I've established there is a provision in the trade and cooperation agreement, Article 167, which requires, I don't think this answers the question, but it's relevant, it requires that a telecommunications provider has a right of appeal before an appeal body independent of the regulatory authority. But it doesn't use the words where the merits are duly taken into account, which appear in the directive. So that is directly effective under Section 29 of EUFRA 2020. But the question is going to be, is that form of word better or worse for an appellant? Is the omission of the words whether merits are duly taken into account, deliberate or not? And that is a question which I think, under the early provisions of the TCA, have to be answered not as a question of EU law, but under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. And that's just an illustration of how all these acts, in the end, interact and give rise to these incredibly difficult issues of interpretation.
So I imagine the CAT would be very grateful if you would continue to frame all challenges as traditional JR grounds, so it doesn't have to think about these questions of the Vienna law on treaties.
Thank you very much. Well, I see time has marched on. Thank you very much for attending today. This will be an area that continues to raise provocative questions, and hopefully UK lawyers will be able to answer some of them. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you for listening to the Litigation Podcast presented by Blackstone Chambers. Subscribe below to receive our latest episodes and visit blackstonechambers.com to learn more.